Okay, we'll go ahead and get started.
I passed back the exams for the in-class students. I'll finish grading the distance students' exams hopefully today and get those back to you by email. Overall, I thought the exam performance was really good. The only problem that wasn't working well was the last problem. And the key thing there was the model we've been primarily talking about has been an FIR LMS algorithm and filter. And so the signal that I gave you was an AR signal. And we talked a little bit about the challenges of estimating an AR signal from using an FIR model. But I think people kind of missed that a little bit. So at least some people. Some people got it right. So that was one problem you might want to take another look at. We spent some time in class talking about IIR approaches, mixed AR, MA approaches, and things like that to estimate the parameters of AR signals. So, other than that, I think people did pretty well. I was very pleased with the results on the first problem. So, today, we sort of begin the second half of the course, and I want to talk about adaptation in a different light, in a more more contemporary light. So I'm going to spend a few slides just setting up the problem for the rest of the semester, and then we'll talk about two tools. This should be expectation, I just noticed. We'll talk about two tools that are very important to the things we'll talk about next to the rest of the semester. One is the expectation maximization algorithm, and one is the concept of linear regression, maximum likelihood linear regression, actually. So we'll spend today setting up some of the background for these things, and then we'll begin applying them next class to a wide variety of techniques. Now, I've provided some links, as I've done for every lecture, to resources that let you go into these in a little more detail. And I think now you actually want to pay attention to these since we don't have a textbook. So you'll find some very nice resources here. We'll be following this last resource, this paper from MIT on linear regression. It's a nice treatment of linear regression. And we've got some course notes on expectation maximization. Also, the students who took the pattern recognition course last semester will note that the lectures on expectation maximization look familiar because they're essentially the same lectures we did in pattern recognition. But since not everyone in this class has the same background, I think we need to bring everybody up to speed. So we'll repeat some of that material, and hopefully the people who've seen it before can answer all the hard questions about it. And then I'll give you a little bit of a heads up. When we get towards the end of the lecture today on linear regression, I am going to ask some questions which I expect answers to, so you'll have to wake up by then and be prepared to participate. I'd like to get a little more class participation going in the second half of the semester. So let me begin by talking about a new view of the adaptation problem. So we call this revisiting the adaptation problem. Previously, we have focused on adaptation. Should be adaptation, not adaption. Adaptation strategies that involve time series data, typically samples of a signal or vectors as a function of time. However, an alternate view of this problem is in terms of models and features. And that's actually where you see a lot of research being done these days. So new data can be in the form of samples of a time series or in the form of new feature vectors. In a lot of pattern recognition applications, the data comes to you in feature vectors, where the vectors that we've discussed are typically represent some estimate of the spectrum or some combination of spectrum and temporal measurements. And these come at you at 100 times a second, 200 times a second, something like that. And the question that with samples that our textbook sort of deals with what's been the classical view of time series analysis, where you deal with the problem of estimating parameters of a model directly from samples of the signal. But the latter, dealing with feature vectors, is much more common in pattern recognition applications, and that's really what we're going to be focusing on for the second half of the semester. So I've got a little graphic to the right here which sort of lays out the problem, and we'll talk about this a little bit. So the reference model is typically derived from extensive amounts of data. In the case of, for example, a voice processing application, you will typically train these models on tens of thousands of hours of voice. And you will use offline techniques to estimate the parameters of the model. So, pointing to this graphic on the upper right, we have essentially a well-trained reference model. Now, this reference model, to process this amount of data and to use some of the very complex parameter estimation techniques that we use, you could literally have years of computer time involved in, even on a supercomputer, years of computer time involved in estimating that reference model. In fact, in some fields, like my field, speech recognition, these reference models actually represent the accumulation of 20 or 30 years worth of research. People every year improve their models based on their previous year's models plus some new data. So it's rare in sophisticated applications that you will actually estimate these reference models from scratch. They're always being updated and adapted, if you will, to new data. Now, that's inherently an offline strategy. So in applications where you're trying to do high-performance pattern recognition in a generic way, you're not about to try to collect that kind of data, let's say from a new customer enrolls into a system, you're not about to try to collect that amount of data from a customer and train models from scratch. So, in fact, in most state-of-the-art pattern recognition problems, the problem is actually adaptation, because you rarely have enough data for a given subject or a given user to train complete models for that user. You'll typically take some models which have been trained or averaged across a large number of users and then apply them to a specific user. For example, I don't know how familiar you are with some of the internet-based things, but one of the really emerging and interesting applications on the internet is this ability for systems to predict purchasing behavior or advertising behavior of users. So when you log on to Amazon.com and you buy something, they say, well, if you bought this, you'd also might be interested in these things. Well, if you think about the models for that, what they're actually doing are a combination of things. They're taking your particular preferences, looking at the types of things you're currently buying, but they're also using a database that's been built on the basis of what all other people in their system have been buying, so that they know that if you buy product X, the general public feels products Y and Z are close to product X, and therefore they suggest those to you. So that's a good example of a system which, even though they're collecting data from you specifically to do this kind of pattern recognition, they're actually using a lot of data from many, many other users. Okay, and then if you look at things like Google, it's the same kind of a situation. Google looks at vast amounts of data and then applies that to your particular search problem. Now, the amount of new data is often orders of magnitude smaller. So over here on the upper right, we show the cloud for new data. And in fact, thinking about it, I should probably make those ellipses different sizes. But the amount of new data can often be on the order of seconds or minutes of voice. When you buy your cell phone, and I don't know if any of you had a chance to use your speech recognition options for your cell phones or some of these things, but when you buy your cell phone, you don't want the store to tell you, okay, now you need to go away for 30 hours and train the system. You expect when you pick up that cell phone, you should be able to use it immediately. And in fact, systems like that can adapt very quickly on the order of seconds of data. Did I start my recording?
Yeah.
Systems can, in applications like that, there's a desire to adapt, begin adaptation after only seconds of data. For example, when you pick up the phone and you make a phone call, and that must be balanced against systems which have been trained on tens of thousands of hours of data. So if you think about that problem, if you simply pool all the data together, all the old data plus the new data, and you re-estimate means and variances and things like that, basically the mean's not going to change because the amount of new data is small compared to the amount of old data. So you have a problem here of how much weight do you give the new data. And, you know, in the extreme, if you give the new data too much weight, and the new data is anomalous, maybe it has noise, or maybe it has a some kind of behavior that's not what you expected from the user, if you train too heavily on that, then the system's going to go off in the wrong direction. So this is a problem that we generically call the generalization problem. How much can you conclude about the new data when the new data is different than the old data? On the other hand, in adaptive systems, we would like to be able to quickly adapt to changes in the environment, or changes in the speaker, or changes in the lighting conditions for the imaging, I mean, any of these kinds of things. So we have to figure out intelligent ways to mix these two amounts of data, even though one data set is very, very large and the other data set is very, very small. Now, the other complicating factor in this is that the reference model normally consists of a large number of parameters, more than can be reliably estimated from only a small amount of new data. One of the things you'll learn in a pattern recognition course is that performance or accuracy of your system is always related to the number of amount of training data you have and the number of free variables in the system. Generally speaking, the more data you have, the more variables you can allocate to the problem and the better performance you can get. So when you're faced with applications where you have tens of thousands of hours of data or the equivalent in imaging or other kinds of analysis, it's not uncommon for your models to have millions of variables associated with them. The speech recognition systems you use on the telephone, for example, you can use cell phones and things, have millions of parameters associated with them. Therefore, you cannot simply re-estimate all those parameters from the new data because there's, in fact, more parameters than new feature vectors. So you have to somehow merge these two models because given the number of parameters involved, you can't simply re-estimate all those parameters from the new data. So the adaptation problem then in this context revolves around the question of how we can best modify the reference model to better match the new data. And not surprisingly, as people thought about this problem, they decided one very interesting way to do that was to postulate a transformation matrix between these two and to try to estimate the parameters of that transformation matrix. The transformation matrix could be something very simple, like a what we know as a whitening transformation with a diagonal covariance, or it could be something very complicated, like a functional form or a hidden Markov model or some such thing. But the key thing here is that the transformation matrix that allows you to map from one to the other is typically low-dimensional transformation compared to the reference model. So rather than having millions of parameters associated with the reference model, you may only have 100 parameters associated with the transformation. And generally, the complexity of the transformation is somewhat related to the amount of new data you have that can support reliable estimation of the parameters of that transformation matrix. So this is the context in which we're going to spend the rest of the semester. We're going to talk about all the different ways we can adapt these reference models to the new data so that we can optimize performance. So what are some of the strategies that we can invoke in doing this? Well, there are a couple, there's sort of three basic ways you can think about this problem. And in fact, state-of-the-art systems use all three of these. One of the things that we did early on was to investigate the concept of normalization of the reference model and the new data to a common space. And that's sort of what I'm showing here in the graphics to the right, is that one approach would be to process the reference data through some normalization, process the new data through the same normalization, and hope that in this process, you bring both of these data sets into a common space. An example of this, taken from, I think a very nice example of this is something we do in speech recognition, where we attempt to estimate the length of your vocal tract. This is called vocal tract length normalization. As you talk, we attempt to estimate the length of your vocal tract, and then we normalize the model by the length, the parameters in the model by the length of your vocal tract as a way of trying to make the system speaker independent. Now, the estimation of that vocal tract length is actually done statistically. So we use a very powerful estimator for that parameter. But that's an attempt to normalize all speakers to a generic speaker, if you will. And the same kind of thing is done in other applications. We'll maybe explore some of that later in the semester. But that's really not what we're interested in adaptation. No, it's a form of adaptation. What we're typically more interested in is the process of either transforming the new data into the reference data space or alternately transforming the reference data into the new space. And this we'll talk about extensively using a transformation like a linear regression type, like a transformation estimated using principles of linear regression. There's a third class of techniques which simply involves re-estimating the model parameters by pooling all the data together. We study in pattern recognition many different ways to do this using concepts like jackknifing, cross-validation, and things like that. We probably will not talk about those in this class, but if you're interested in this kind of a thing, you can study the pattern recognition course to learn more about that. We will, however, talk about in a moment one technique that does try to make use of this, because it's one of the two techniques that are very common for adaptation. Now, the latter approach is often not practical for two reasons. The computational complexity of the re-estimation process is significant and would typically have to be performed offline. A technology or organization like Google, for example, tries to recompute parameters of its model continuously. And that's a very daunting task because they built a database that contains just about every page in the internet that they can find. And that's an enormous database. And simply re-estimating, you can't re-estimate a complex statistical model on that data every night. On the other hand, in some applications, it's very reasonable that you re-estimate parameters overnight and then load parameters so that when the user begins the next day, those parameters are available. But the other problem, as we discussed, is that the new data is dwarfed by the amount of old data. So in situations like this, it's very hard to really move the models very quickly because the amount of the impact of the new data is very, very small. So we're going to focus mostly in this class on the problem of transforming the model to match the statistics of the new data. And since the amount of new data is small, the number of parameters associated with this transformation must be small, much less than the original model. We would also prefer this adaptation process to run close to real time or online, meaning that the new model parameters are available shortly after the new data arrives, rather than waiting overnight for the parameters to update. Now, that's actually a very interesting issue, because the first technique we'll talk about, maximum likelihood linear regression, actually requires it's a batch mode process. So you have to take a chunk of data, collect that data, and then re-estimate the parameters. Now, that's practical for some applications, But if you have an application that's truly real time, where you want the system responding immediately after user input, that's not an acceptable approach. You need some kind of adaptation that's much faster than that. And that's actually why we talk about the time series analysis type adaptation approaches, because the one advantage of these approaches, the LMS algorithm, for example, is that it's constantly adapting as each new data point arrives. But in a lot of applications, we prefer a batch mode process where we collect a small amount of data and then update the parameters based on that data, but update doesn't start until we've collected that data. And this trade-off of latency in the adaptation versus real-time responsiveness, this is a very real problem or a system design issue in almost any system. The longer you wait, the better you can do. If I can look across a larger amount of data, I can get better at adaptation than if I'm forced to do adaptation in real time. So that's another parameter that we won't talk a lot about in this second section of the course. We're going to assume a batch mode environment where we've collected a small amount of data and now we want to update parameters based on that data. But in many applications, that amount of latency is unacceptable. For example, when you, if you're talking to a voice response system, you would, when you speak, you expect the system to respond. If you have to wait, let's say you speak for 3 seconds, if you have to wait another 3 seconds for the system to process your data, that's pretty annoying. If you have to wait for 15 minutes before the system updates the parameters and processes your voice, that's annoying. Now, in some applications, that may work. If it's a dictation system or a transcription system, that may work. But another good example of that is if you've noticed closed captioning on television. That's an application where you need the results very, very quickly. And you can sometimes see the latency, whether it's a human operator or machine-generated output, you can sometimes see the latency. And sometimes, one of the ways we bridge this gap, which you can sometimes see, is that a initial transcription will be output, and then they'll go back and correct that with subsequent stages of processing. So there are a lot of different ways we can do this, but a lot of that involves engineering issues that we won't really spend much time on in this course. Now, there's bringing this into a more statistical framework. There's two basic types of adaptation that we're going to talk about today. We'll talk about over the next few weeks. One is maximum a priori or MAP estimation. And this involves choosing an estimate that maximizes the posterior probability that's consistent with the observed data and prior information. And the second is maximum likelihood linear regression, which uses a maximum likelihood approach to estimate parameters of a transformation of the feature vectors or model parameters. Now, again, if you're not comfortable with the differences between these two and this concept of prior information, that's something we study extensively in the pattern recognition course. The basic difference between these two is that in one case, we're taking into account all the prior information we have about the data, whereas in another case, we're simply trying to look at only the new data and assume that every feature vector in that new data is essentially equally likely. To understand either of these approaches, however, we need to introduce several new analysis and modeling tools. And two of the most important and basic are the the expectation maximization algorithm, or theorem, and maximum likelihood linear regression. The expectation maximization theorem describes a technique for guaranteeing that our new parameter estimates are better than the previous estimate. And what we'll do today is we'll go through the derivation of this theorem, because this is fundamental to most adaptation techniques of this class. It's not just the result of the theorem that says the new models are better than the old models, but the theorem actually gives us a technique for creating the re-estimation equations that allow us to achieve this improvement in performance. So you have to understand the theorem to understand the algorithms that are based on the theorem. Maximum likelihood linear regression, on the other hand, it describes a statistical approach to fitting a model, typically a line or regression function, to the data. We've actually seen this already with least squares analysis, but I will now sort of formalize this and show you that what you know is the least squares model is also a maximum likelihood linear regression model under certain statistical assumptions. In contrast to techniques that minimize the mean squared error, like our LMS algorithm, our goal here will be to produce a model that is better than the previous model. That is, in general, a complicated question that depends on how you define better. Again, because we have this generalization problem, better on one data set may not be better on another data set. And you know, there's a lot of subtlety to this issue of what is better, but we're going to focus mainly on a simple what's called a generative approach that estimates the probability that training data could have been generated from the model. And we're going to use as a measure of performance the likelihood or the probability that the model could have generated the training data. And we're going to try to adjust the parameters of the model to maximize the probability of the generative model. That's been a fairly successful technique for a while. But we're also going to talk about discriminative versions of this later in the course. And again, if you want a more thorough treatment of these issues, consult the pattern recognition course. Okay, so let's first spend a few minutes talking about and then deriving the expectation maximization theorem. Expectation maximization, or what's called EM, is an approach that's used in many ways to find maximum likelihood estimates of parameters in probabilistic models. EM is an iterative optimization method to estimate some unknown parameters given some measurement data. It's used in a variety of contexts to estimate missing data or discover hidden variables. The intuition behind EM is an old one, alternating between estimating the unknowns, called the expectation step, and then optimizing the likelihood, called the maximization step. This idea has been around for a long time. As we'll see in a moment, rather than doing this simultaneously, you do it in an alternate way. You re-estimate the parameters, then you estimate the likelihoods, then you go back and re-estimate the parameters. The key innovation in this happened in the late 1970s when Dempster and his colleagues proved convergence of this approach and explained the relationship to maximum likelihood estimation. At that point, many people started applying this to different disciplines, and it began to supplant mean squared error estimation as the preferred way to estimate parameters. EM alternates between performing an expectation step, which we call the E step, which computes an expectation of the likelihood by including latent variables as they were observed, and then a maximization step, which computes the maximum likelihood estimates of the parameters by maximizing the expected likelihood found on the E-step. The parameters found on the M-step are then used to begin another E-step, and the process is repeated. Now, this concept of latent variables, well, that's one of the things we'll sort of introduce when we go through the derivation of the theorem. But this is another concept that you see very often in optimization problems. If you think about, for example, the Lagrange multipliers, we use the same kind of a technique with Lagrange multipliers. We introduce an additional set of constraints, an additional free variable, the Lagrange multiplier, and then we simultaneously solve for the optimal value of the Lagrange multiplier and the parameters of the model. And the EM is essentially the same kind of situation where we introduce these latent variables, and then we do this optimization with respect to both the latent variables and the parameter models. This approach is the cornerstone of important algorithms such as hidden Markov modeling and discriminative training, and it has been applied to fields varying from human language technology to image processing. EM is pretty common, has been a pretty common approach for through about the early 2000, and then you see people then begin to move towards extensions of this based on discriminative training and then things even beyond concept of EM. So to prove the EM theorem, however, we're going to need to invoke, in a critical step, something known as Jensen's inequality. So we have to discuss Jensen's inequality before we prove the EM algorithm. So Jensen's inequality, it's an inequality that deals with the relationship between two discrete probability distributions. Now, one of the key things we have to remember about probability distributions, when we have a continuous random variable, its probability distribution, which is often called P of X, has a constraint that the integral of P of X is, with respect to X is equal to 1. And with a discrete random variable, we have the same constraint that the sum of X, the sum of P of X over X has to be equal to 1. That constraint turns out to be very important and constrains these distributions, especially when you're comparing two distributions. It serves as sort of a normalization constraint, because if P of X is greater than Q of X over one region of X, it has to be less than Q of X over some other region of X, because the two have to balance out, because each distribution is constrained to have a unit area. And therefore, that creates a lot of interesting properties about comparing probability distributions, because you just cannot have a situation where over all of X, P of X is greater than Q of X. That would work if we didn't have this additional constraint about the sum of P of X being equal to 1. So Jensen's inequality, the concept of divergence, and a lot of other metrics in information theory really exploit this concept that the area under the area underneath the curve of a probability distribution is constrained to be equal to 1. So, the lemma states that if P of X and Q of X are two discrete probability distributions, then the sum of P of X times log P of X over X must be greater than or equal to the sum of P of X over log Q of X, with equality if and only if P of X is equal to Q of X. Now, at first look, this might seem strange. This says that if you have a distribution P of X, P of X log P of X has to be greater than or equal to P of X times log of any other probability distribution. And we must sort of reflect on that. Well, why must this be? Well, as I said, part of the reason this is true is because of the additional constraint that the sum of P of X must be equal to 1. But this quantity, sum P of X log P of X, where have we seen that quantity before? And if my pattern recognition students don't answer this, I'll be very disappointed.
Entropy.
Very good. Very good. That's essentially entropy-related quantity. What do we know about what do we know about probability distributions and entropy? So what is entropy? And my pattern recognition students better answer this question, because I must have asked them this 50 times in the spring. It's the uncertainty, it measures the uncertainty of the random variable, right? So when we have the concept that a distribution, the sum of P of X is constrained to be 1, we also have the concept of maximum entropy, right? What is the maximum entropy distribution for a discrete random variable, not a continuous random variable?
Uniform.
It's a uniform distribution, because that's the most random or the least constraining distribution. If we have a continuous random variable, what is the maximum entropy? A Gaussian or normal distribution. So this is essentially a variant of that concept, that one way to think about this is that P of X, this P of X log P of X, this is essentially the entropy. This P of X log Q of X is essentially the divergence. And the reason part of the reason this is true is because of the concept that of that maximum entropy, essentially. So this is true with quality if and only if P of X is equal to Q of X, and that's why sometimes this is used to, this results in a measure we call divergence, which is a way of measuring the similarity between two probability distributions. So the proof of this is rather straightforward. We can take the sum of P of X log P of X minus the sum of P of X log Q of X, and we want to show that that's greater than or equal to zero. We can collapse these sums and write this as the sum of P of X times the log of P of X over Q of X, since the difference of two logarithms is simply the ratio of the arguments. And we can turn that around and say, well, this must mean that the sum of P of X log Q of X over P of X must be less than or equal to zero. The sum of P of X log Q of X over P of X, this is less than or equal to the sum of P of X times Q of X over P of X minus 1. And this is because, of course, this property that probability distributions must sum to 1. So then we can multiply this out and write that this means that the sum of P of X minus the sum of Q of X must be equal to 0. So therefore, this quantity on the left-hand side is less than or equal to this quantity, but this quantity is equal to 0. So therefore, this quantity on the left-hand side must be less than or equal to 0. So the last step follows because probability distribution sum to 1 or integrate to 1 if it's a continuous random variable. So Jensen's inequality relates the value of a convex function of an integral to the integral of the convex function, and it's used extensively in information theory. You'll see this a lot. You'll see the concept of divergence, which is a extension of this theorem. So we'll make use of that in a moment. So now let's go ahead and formally state the EM theorem, and then we'll go through a fairly simple derivation of the theorem. And if this is your first introduction to the EM theorem, you may get stuck in the notation a little bit, since we haven't spent a lot of time building up the notation. But I'll try to explain things as clearly as possible. But if you have some questions, please don't hesitate to ask, because the notation is sort of where can be deceptive, but it's really important to understand this in terms of the notation. So what the theorem states is that the sum over t, and t are going to be our latent variables, the sum over t of the probability of theta prime. Theta prime is some new estimate of our parameters. So we have theta, which are our current parameters, and theta prime, which are our new parameters. Well, actually, in this case, we're going to say that theta are, we hope, are the better parameters, and theta prime are the old parameters. So these are two different estimates of the parameters. And we have that the probability of theta prime of t, these hidden variables, given y, y represents our measurements or our observable data. The probability of t given y times the log of the probability of t given y under the model theta. So here we have the probability of theta prime of t given y under the model theta prime times the log of the probability of t given y under the model theta. This term is greater than the probability of t given y under the model theta prime. You know, why this is important to us is because theta will represent the new estimates, essentially, and theta prime will represent the old estimates. So if we can prove this is true, in the process of proving this, we can create an algorithm that describes how we can form the new estimates theta given the old estimates theta prime and the observable data y. And therefore, that's why this theorem also becomes an algorithm, because in proving this theorem, we prove it under the condition that we re-estimate the parameters of the model in a certain way. So let y denote the observable data. Let p theta sub theta primed of y be the probability distribution of y under some model whose parameters are denoted by theta prime. Let p of theta, p sub theta of y be the corresponding distribution under a different setting of the parameter theta. And our goal is to prove that y is more likely under the model theta than under the model theta prime. So let t denote some hidden or latent parameters that are governed by the values of theta. Because p of sub theta primed of t given y is a probability distribution that sums to 1, we can write that the log of p sub theta of y minus the log of p sub theta primed of y must be equal to, well, we can just essentially write out these expectations as the sum over t of p sub theta prime of t given y times the log of p sub theta of y minus the sum over t of p sub theta prime of t given y times the log of p of theta prime of y. So you can see how we're going to try to leverage Jensen's inequality here, because we essentially have p of x, q of x, p of x, p of x. Because we can exploit the dependence of y on t, and using the well-known properties of conditional probability distribution. So these t parameters are hidden parameters because the model theta is going to be dependent on the model t. So there's a dependence between y and t. So we can multiply each of these terms here by what we call by a value 1, which for the case of the first term is going to be p sub theta of t and y divided by p sub theta of t and y. And then in the second term, we're going to take the joint with respect to theta prime. So even though we have a theta here and a theta prime here, since the ratio of these two terms is equal to 1, it's okay to do this multiplication. It's a little bit of a trick, you could say, but it allows us to decompose these probabilities into something that we can use Jensen's inequality on. So then we can take this first term, and we can write that we can carry the numerator down. Now the denominator, we have p of theta, p sub theta of t, the joint t and y divided by, if we take this term and move it down here, divided by p sub theta of y. That's just a marginal p sub theta of t given y. And for the second term, we can do the same thing, and we have the marginal of p of theta primed of t given y. So we can then basically split these logs out. We can take p theta prime of t given y times the log of the numerator minus the log of the denominator, so we've got essentially four terms here because we have the log of a over b and the log of c over d. So we're going to basically split those apart and take the numerator here, and then the denominator here. The denominator of this second term and the denominator of the first term. So splitting out these logs, we can write these four individual terms and paying attention to the signs. Now these four terms, though, we can use Jensen's inequality to say, well, these four terms must be greater than or equal to simply this first term minus the second term, because these two terms, this term must be guaranteed to be greater than or equal to zero using Jensen's inequality. So what we've shown is that the log of this p sub theta of y, going back to the beginning, minus the log of p of theta prime piece of theta prime of y is greater than or equal to the sum over t of p sub theta prime of t given y times the log of p sub theta of t and y minus the sum of p sub theta prime of t given y times the log of p of theta prime of t given t and y. So what exactly have we shown here? Well, we've shown that the last quantity has to be greater than or equal to zero. If the last quantity, rather, is greater than or equal to zero, then the new model will be better than the old model. And that's what's key about this term on the left. This is essentially the log likelihood of the new model minus the log likelihood of the old model. And we've shown that that can be greater than or equal to zero if we follow, and that's sort of the key thing here, if we construct our re-estimation process in a manner consistent with this theorem. So this suggests a strategy for finding the new parameters theta. We want to choose the values of theta to make this last quantity positive. And if we choose the values of theta to do that, then we guarantee that this will be the case. So the theorem is a little bit deceptive because we introduce these hidden variables and we adjust the new parameters theta such that we guarantee this difference between the two entropies, essentially, not quite entropies, but is greater than or equal to zero. And once we do that, we guarantee then that the new model is more likely than the old model. So if we continue to do this process, we're going to essentially guarantee that the likelihood of the new model, the likelihood that the new model generated the data is greater than the likelihood of that the old model generated the data. So this suggests a strategy for estimating or updating our model parameters or in an iterative way so that the new model is continually getting better than the old model. And that's essentially what the EM theorem is all about. Now, how we actually do that is going to depend on the details of the model. So what we'll do next time with respect to this is we will actually show how we can create a re-estimation process for the parameters of the model in terms of these quantities. So the theorem in itself, like a lot of theorems, is not terribly useful because it doesn't tell us how to actually do it. It just tells us that if we do it in a way that follows this, we will be guaranteed that the model gets better. Now, fortunately for a lot of problems like Gaussian problems where we're trying to estimate, we're trying to fit data with Gaussian models, we can derive nice closed form expressions for how to estimate the parameters using EM such that the models behave this way. But for some problems, you don't get these nice closed form solutions. And we'll talk about that more extensively when we talk about maximum likelihood linear regression. Okay, so for the moment, just we'll sort of keep this in our bag of tools, that we have a theorem which describes a way to define a re-estimation process such that the parameters get better. So if we start with the parameter setting theta prime and we find a parameter setting for theta for which our inequality holds, then the observed data y will be more probable than theta than under theta prime. The name expectation maximization comes about because we take the expectation of this p of theta, p sub theta of t and y, let me try to go back here.
That was the wrong direction.
So if you look at these terms, These are essentially expectations because you're averaging this log over the probability of that log. So the key step in terms of parameter estimation with the EM algorithm is the expectation, where we take the expectation of P sub theta of T and Y with respect to the old distribution, P sub theta prime, and then we maximize the expectation as a function of the argument theta. Critical to the success of the algorithm is the choice of the proper intermediate variable T that will allow finding the maximum of the expectation. Now, for a lot of problems, such as hidden Markov modeling, that kind of works itself out naturally, but there is a bit of design work involved in finding the right intermediate variables for this process. But it turns out that's actually an opportunity, because oftentimes our modeling problem really involves trying to estimate underlying structure of the data from the observables. So for example, if we're talking about the Amazon.com application, where we're trying to estimate these underlying parameters of a model that predicts your purchasing behavior, what Amazon's really interested in is knowing what drives your purchasing behavior. And these underlying variables represent, or these intermediate variables represent essentially that information of sort of what's the underlying structure to the data. If we're talking about an application like speech recognition, the underlying parameters often are things like phonemes or states in models of phonemes. So that even though we're recognizing your voice in terms of words, we're also producing estimates of the phonemes and some of the underlying structure from these parameters. And the same is true for many pattern recognition applications. If you're doing some kind of object recognition and image processing, you still have a core set of building blocks that you're using to decompose objects into, and those become the underlying variables. The most prominent use of EM in pattern recognition is probably to derive the Baum-Welsh re-estimation equations for hidden Markov model. And for many years, people kind of confused the two, but the two are two distinct concepts, the EM algorithm and the Baum-Welsh re-estimation. The EM algorithm shows us that Baum-Welsh re-estimation converges, but Baum-Welsh re-estimation is just one of many ways to re-estimate parameters. And once people understood this, many other EM-based algorithms were derived that had nothing to do with Baum-Welsh re-estimation. So today it's common to see people talk about, for example, I was looking last night at some image processing stuff, EM ways to do segmentation of images, EM ways to do almost any kind of decision-making process that are completely separate from hidden Markov models or from Baum-Welsh re-estimation. Okay, so, hello, there we go. Okay, I think that's right, okay. So now let me spend the next 20 minutes in class talking about a second tool that we're going to need, which is linear regression. And then what we will do next class is begin combining the concepts of EM estimation and linear regression to produce something called maximum likelihood linear regression. So let me spend a few minutes talking about linear regression in a sort of a general way, and to try to tie together the concept of minimum mean squared error and eventually maximum likelihood estimation. So suppose we're given a sequence of observations. We'll treat these for the purpose of this derivation as a set of ordered pairs. We have x1, y1, x2, y2, and so forth. We have n of these values. Now, in many problem spaces, this requires, to do this kind of analysis, requires you to have what's called a labeled training set. You need to have some data where you know the inputs and you know the corresponding outputs. So, in the context of, for example, a stock market application, you might be trying to model the stock market price, let's say the Dow Jones average, which has been fluctuating a lot basically today, or the last few weeks. you might want to mark, your Y's might be the Dow Jones average, the output. Your inputs might be the price of oil, the price of, I don't know, other things that you're trying to build a relationship, dependency relationship with.
Interest rate,
very good, right, your input. And why might you want a model of the Dow Jones average in terms of, if you can answer this, I'll be impressed. Why might you want a model of the Dow Jones average as a function of interest rates and the price of gasoline, let's say? So if that model was instantaneous, it might not be so much use to you. And yesterday was a very good example. Stock market rose 900 points yesterday. So if you were smart enough to invest in the morning, in fact, I heard this morning that one of the major firms, but one of these major investment firms, their stock rose 87% yesterday. 87%. So if you were smart enough to invest in the morning and sold in the afternoon, you could have made a fortune. And that's one of the reasons, I guess, why the stock market went up so much. There were a number of people trying to make money on the thing. But if your model is instantaneous, it's not so much of use to you, because I don't need a model to tell me that at noon yesterday, you know, to predict the price of the Dow Jones index at the price of the gas at noon, the price of gas at noon at the interest rate at noon. What I really need is a model that's going to be able to tell me what's going to happen tomorrow, right? So the reason price of oil is a good indicator is because you can actually forecast the price of oil in a cyclic way. There are certain times of the year, for whatever reasons, oil goes up and it goes down, and you can predict that ahead of time. One of the times the price of oil goes up is as we approach the winter season, the heating season in the United States, and oil's in more demand, so oil rises. So if you have this kind of a model, you can do prediction. And I think that's often lost in some of these modeling techniques. Is it's not, you know, these functions that explain behavior are good, but that's still not, but we have to go one step further, and we have to be able to do what's called inference, guessing about the future. So if we understand the relationship, we can actually predict, hopefully, the future, because we know if the model is in terms of things we understand, like interest rates and oil, and if the result, if they change the interest rates today, and that doesn't take effect until tomorrow, that's a really good situation if you have a good model, right? Because if they change the interest rates today and stocks immediately react to that, that's a little bit harder. But if you know there's a little bit of latency, then you can essentially make money.
But I read newspaper, this time's crisis is because some people use some number to compute some model, and then it works the first button. Eventually, the model just failed, and now it's a crisis.
Exactly. So I was teaching a pattern recognition course. We had a run there where the stock market fluctuated, and the theory was that all these computer models were playing against each other, and people were automatically trading based on computer models, and the system suddenly became unstable because the models were feeding on each other. And then you're right. At some point, the models no longer do good prediction, and then the system kind of crashes. And I think the same thing, there's some argument about that, the economy this past few weeks, that same kind of thing. There was a lot of speculation, and people invest based on speculation, based on modeling, and that can create a very volatile situation. So therefore, it's not good enough just to know the model, but you also want to know the error. And unfortunately, the problem with all this is you need labeled data, right? And if your labeled data comes from a year ago, which it often does in pattern recognition applications, you spend a lot of time collecting labeled data. That data may not be valid because it may have aged. the parameters driving the stock market right now may be very different than the parameters driving the stock market a year ago. So all your labeled data may be useless. So, you know, the beauty of these techniques always impress me because they seem so powerful. But then ultimately you realize it's only as good as the labeled data. And therefore you become, to be very good at this kind of pattern recognition, you have to really understand the data itself, what drives your application space. Nevertheless, we will go through this fairly quickly. It's fairly straightforward. So we have inputs, X's. Often we decide what those inputs are. We decide it's interest rate. We decide it's the price of oil. We decide it's the time of day, time of year. And then we have the outputs, our actual observables. And the reason we're interested in the regression model is we're trying to come up with some underlying model of the relationship between of y as a function of x. Now, the most obvious way to do this would be to minimize the mean squared error. I believe many of you, I did when I was a student, the first time I was introduced to this concept was in physics class, when you were asked to run an experiment and to guess at the relationship between, for example, force and acceleration. And you go into the lab and you collect a lot of data, and as usually happens with real world experiments, the data is all over the place, and you're asked to estimate a relationship between these two. And very often, the first question you'll ask is, well, is the relationship linear? Is the relationship quadratic? Is the relationship cubic or some other thing? But a linear approximation is always a good start. And the obvious way to estimate the parameters of this model are to minimize the mean squared error. In fact, in your freshman physics class or high school physics class, you probably drew a line across the page. And if you didn't realize at the time, visually you're minimizing the error. People are very good at that. This is often sometimes called trend analysis as well. So we can estimate, we can define an error function L, which is the sum of the mean of the squared errors. And we can find the optimal values of L by differentiating L with respect to the variables of interest, beta 0 and beta 1. So we can take the derivative of L with respect to beta 0, and that's just going to be twice the argument times the derivative of the argument. And since beta 0 only appears here, everything falls out, and we just have this fairly simple equation that the sum from I equals 1 to n of 2 times the argument is equal to 0. The derivative for beta 1 gets a little more interesting because we have the quadratic, so we have 2 times the argument, 2 times y sub I minus the quantity beta 0 plus beta 1 x sub I, times the derivative of the argument, which if we differentiate this argument with respect to beta 1, the only term that's non-zero is this beta 1 times x sub I. So we have x sub I here. So we get that as equal to 0. So now we have two equations, two unknowns. And fortunately, these equations are linear, so we can fairly easily solve these. But to do that, we'll introduce some common statistical quantities to simplify our equations a bit. We'll call x bar as the mean of x, x sub I, which is just the sum over n of x sub I. We'll have y bar, which is the sum, the mean of y sub I, and we'll have the variance of x squared, which is just the sum of x squared, and the cross correlation between x and y as the sum of x sub I times y sub I. So with these variables, we can solve these two equations. Well, right, we can basically write these equations as here we have the, from this first equation, we have the average of y is equal to beta 0 plus beta 1 times the average of x. And then from the second equation, we have that we have the sum of y sub I times x sub I, which is just this xy bar, is equal to beta 0 times x, the average of x plus beta 1 times the average of x squared. So two equations, two unknowns, and we can solve these two equations for beta 1 and beta 0, and we can write that beta 1 is equal to xy bar minus x minus the product of x bar and y bar over x bar squared minus the average of x squared. And then we can also show that beta 0 is equal to y minus b1 times x. And I said I was going to wake you up at the end of class. So, and I hope my pattern recognition students can answer this. And I've given you a hint, so it's not too hard. So this is linear regression. Now the question is, what are the strengths and weaknesses of this approach? Why do we try to go beyond linear regression in pattern recognition, for example? So I give you this nice technique. Draws a line, it allows you to fit this data to a linear function. But is that the end of the story? There are some interesting implicit assumptions in this approach that you might not have thought about before that are going to influence our, that relate to our problem of adaptation. Well, let's go, you need more hints? Let's go back to your physics experiment. What was the problem when you ran these experiments in high school or college? You know, you were actually in the lab measuring these things. If you remember back in your physics experiment, so you go in the lab and you collect all the data, right? And then you go home and you analyze it. What was the first thing that invariably happened when you got home and you looked at the data? I like to tell this story because it's basically how I survived high school chemistry. So I had a high school chemistry teacher who required us to sign our data sheets. I probably shouldn't tell this story since I'm recording, but my chemistry teacher died, so it won't matter. But he used to make us sign our data sheets when we left the lab. And then when you turned in the lab report, you had to turn in those data sheets that were signed. Now, this caused a problem for those of us who were really skilled at getting A's in courses, but weren't brilliant. You know, we kind of had to work. You go home and you analyze the data. The problem is there's always one or two points way out here, right? Outliers. Now, that's a problem because you're trying to get really good results, but you've signed your name to this piece of paper that says, this was the data that I collected in the lab. But you know those points are outliers, and if you could just make those points go away, you could make your experimental data look a lot better, and you could get the right answer, you can get an A on the lab report, right? So I won't say any more about what we used to do in high school to get around this problem, but you can figure out that there was no way I could turn in the data sheet that I signed because it had bad data. So I had to do something, but I signed that data sheet. So I like, you know, that was taught me some very valuable skills in life. Not all legal, of course. But anyway, so you've got outliers. What's the problem with this model with respect to outliers? Come on, pattern recognition guys. These two guys took my pattern recognition course last semester. And they got an A, so they're experts. What's the problem with this model with respect to an outlier? There's sort of two ways an outlier will really mess up this model. This model treats all data equally, right? That's what I mean by uniform weighting. But we know this is an outlier. We know this point is an outlier, but there's no real way to de-emphasize it. So that is a problem. That's compounded by the fact that it's a quadratic, a mean squared error model. So that outlier's contribution is going to be related to the square of the error. That outlier, if that outlier is way out here, that's going to dominate the parameter fit because the metric is a quadratic. So that's a big problem with these models. They're not terribly robust to prior information. You know, and that's why a whole new generation of statistical techniques have been developed that attempt to take into account our prior knowledge of the problem and our sort of expectations about the data. And they allow us to, for example, de-emphasize data points we believe are not reliable. So, this is a very good model, but it treats all data equally, and it does not make it take into account the prior probability of particular data points. So, the model is going to be dominated by data points which are most likely from a prior probability point of view. And in some problems, that may be good, in some problems, that may be bad. But in general, the model is bad because all data is treated equally, and that's not necessarily the way problems work in the real world. So we're going to look at this problem next time from a statistical approach and show that this solution is also the maximum likelihood solution. And therefore, we'll call this maximum likelihood linear regression. And then we'll go and we'll apply this to the problem of the feature transformation problem. But before I do that, I wanted to generalize the model and show that if we have, instead of a single scalar, we have a vector of inputs, and we want to estimate a scalar output. Still, we want to estimate the price of the stock market, the Dow Jones Index, but we want to do that with a multiple inputs. We can formulate a regression model that involves multiple variables, and we can then formulate a minimum mean squared error in the same way. We can write this information in matrix form. We have a data matrix, we have an observation matrix, we have a parameter vector, and the optimal solution that minimizes the mean squared error is nothing more than our normal equations. Fairly easy to show this, which is just X transpose X inverse. This is just the autocorrelation matrix times X transpose Y. So this is a solution that you've already seen. This is our LMS solution. It's just cast in a slightly different framework. So what we've done today is to introduce a general statistical framework for adaptation. We discussed two general approaches to this problem: maximum a priori estimation and maximum likelihood linear regression, and I'll talk a little bit more about both of those next class. We introduced two tools that we will need to use to develop these approaches. One is the expectation maximization algorithm, and the other is the concept of linear regression. We derived the equations for the estimation of the parameters of the linear regression model using mean squared error and showed that those were equivalent to our normal equations that we previously derived in the first half of this course. Now, the next thing we'll do, as I mentioned, is we're going to show that the linear regression equations actually represent a maximum likelihood solution under particular statistical assumptions about the variables. And then we'll introduce the concept of map adaptation. And then I think the class after that will actually discuss the technique known as maximum likelihood linear regression adaptation and talk about how we can estimate a transformation vector for the features using MLLR approaches. Okay? All right, see you on Thursday.